Jonathan Schmelz and all the people at Grant Thornville put this event together. And obviously a very special thank you to Rob Schachter taking time out of his busy schedule to speak at this event. Just a few words about the AFP network, as its shortened name is called. They have three real objectives for the AFP network, which is running educational seminars on various topics for accounting and financial planning professionals and anyone else in complementary fields. We also try to run networking events for people, anyone who wants to come, really YU alumni, friends of YU, people that are professionals in the area that also work in the accounting and financial planning field. And also organizing symposiums like this one to take a Torah Umada approach to personal finance by illustrating how secular topics and financial planning are intertwined with concepts in halakha. Some other events we ran before it became official group included halakha and estate planning of creating a legacy, estate and financial planning for chronic illness, post-graduation, laying the foundation for a successful financial future, and optimizing your retirement benefits, Social Security, Medicare, and pension maximization. We hope to run many more of these type events in the future. Also, hopefully, we'll have a lot of them with a kind of a Torah bent or the halakhic aspects kind of mixed in. Today, we have a distinguished panel of speakers that will give us some insight on both the halakhic and secular aspects of charitable giving. Here to moderate the discussion and to introduce our panel is Jack Katz. Jack is the regional managing partner of the Northeast region of Grant Thornton and national managing partner of the financial services industry group at the firm. He's chairman of Grant Thornton's partnership board and has spent more than 30 years in public accounting. Jack is a frequent speaker at professional forums, is widely quoted, and has authored numerous articles in various trade publications. It gives me great pleasure to introduce Jack Katz.
Thanks very much. Thank you. Actually, first, we're very proud to host this event. In fact, when Jonathan mentioned it to me a number of weeks ago, I thought it was a great idea to, especially to have the privilege to have Rav Schachter come and address people in our offices. It brings us to new heights within our own firm. So I'm very happy that we're able to sponsor and to support Yeshiva University with this event tonight. From the standpoint of the presentation, it's quite interesting in that we'll have the halakhic and the religious approach to charitable giving, as I'm sure very few people could do it, as only Rav Schachter could do it. And I've had the opportunity, as many of us have had over the years, to hear Rav Schachter in various forums, whether it's in my community in the Young Israel Widmere or in other symposiums or forums. I had an opportunity to hear him a number of times during this past summer. And he just flows, and I once said, I commented him almost as a glider effortlessly from the standpoint of the way he delivers his information and the way he speaks in front of the crowd. And from that standpoint, I'm sure we'll all very much enjoy what he has to say. I mentioned to him before the program started that this past week my wife and I were listening on the internet to a discussion that he had at the yeshiva in Israel, and someone happened to ask him, what was it like to be in the shira of Rabbi Soloveitchik? And from then, he went off on a 10-15-minute discussion, some of it quite serious, and discussing the sternness and the approach that Rabbi Soloveitchik had in the shira, also quite humorous as well. So it was very enjoyable to listen to that. And at certain points, I missed it because I was sitting in the room. I said to my wife, what did he say? Because it happened to have been, from a continuity standpoint, a very interesting discussion. So I'm sure you could find it on the YU Torah Network, whatever it's officially called, and you'll be able to hear the discussion, but it was quite interesting. Also speaking tonight is Jonathan Schmelz. And Jonathan, my friend, my colleague, sitting two seats down, is the head of our financial services tax practice, which is based in our downtown office, which is quite a very large practice, in fact, the largest industry practice within our office in New York and the second largest industry practice within our firm. And he's truly one of the recognized experts in the financial services tax space, particularly when it comes to hedge funds and private equity funds, where he's been the chairman of the New York State Society of CPAs on investment partnerships and other related financial products. And he speaks quite often in the area relating to the financial services with a particular focus in the hedge fund space and private equity space. In addition to that, He handles some very substantial high net worth individuals that often are associated with our financial services practice. That's Jonathan's background. And since we do have to conform as citizens of the United States to Dina de Malchus Adina, we have to make sure that we do our charitable giving, we do it in an appropriate fashion. And therefore, Jonathan has next to him Miriam Greenberg, also within our financial services high net worth practice, here to answer questions, make a presentation, as well as answer any questions that might come up from a tax perspective. But first, from a halachic and a religious perspective, we'll turn it over to Rabbi Shachar.
Thank you very much. Good evening, everybody. We all know that there is a mitzvah to give tzedakah. The Chumash doesn't tell us exactly what the minimum amount is, how much they have to give in order to fulfill the mitzvah. The Gemara in Bava Basra in the first pair quotes a pasuk that one has to give a minimum of a shlishis ha-shekel, a third of a shekel every year, and if that's way less than $10, even the poorest person in the world has to go rob a bank or do something in order to give a shlishis ha-shekel. Otherwise, it's not yotzei. If you rob a bank, you're not yotzei in the mitzvah. So you have to give it your own money. Okay, take it back. Okay, I was kidding. So if you don't give a shlishis ha-shekel, you're not in fulfillment of the mitzvah. This mitzvah of tzedakah is one of the mitzvahs that depends on who you are. If a multimillionaire is going to give a shlishis ha-shekel, a third of a shekel every year, he won't be in fulfillment of the mitzvah. We have the mitzvah in the Chumash that on Pesach Shavuos Sukkos, all of the Jewish men have to visit the Beis HaMikdash, Aliyah LeRegel, they have to bring an oilas riyah and different korbanos, shal nechagiga, and the pasuk says, ish ki matnas yada ki birkas Hashem alakecha, Hashem asalach, depending how much you can afford and depending how big your family is. If you have a bigger family, so you should bring more shlamim. If you have a smaller family, so bring more oilas. If you can afford more, bring more oilas. Can't afford it, bring less. Same thing as the mitzvah of Talmud Torah. If a person is busy all day and all night, so he's yotzei with the he has to learn v'hagisba yama v'loyla a little bit in the daytime, a little bit at nighttime. So he learns 10 minutes in the daytime, 10 minutes in the nighttime is yotzei. If a person is retired and has a lot of time on his hands, and he can understand Torah, so he's not yotzei if he just learns 10 minutes a day, 10 minutes a night. It depends how much free time you have. That's by definition. The mitzvah Talmud Torah is whenever you have free time, you have an obligation to learn. Tzedakah is the same. Asher l'fi asher, if a wealthy man is going to give shlishis ha-shekel, he will not be in fulfillment of the mitzvah. The Gemara tells the story that one of the Rabbanim must have had a parnasa on the side. One of the Rabbanim wasn't giving the proper amount of tzedakah that he should have given, so they were kai for him. The other Rabbanim, the Bezdin in the city, forced him to pay a much higher amount. He never pledged anything, even without pledging. They determined he wasn't giving enough considering how much he was earning, and they pressured him, they forced him till he gave the proper amount of tzedakah. Tosfos on that Gemara has a famous discussion that the Gemara says in another place, in Chulin, in the beginning of Perek HaLabasa, the Gemara talks about Kibud Aviyim, that there was a character who was mezalzel in fulfilling the mitzvah of Kibud Aviyim, showing honor towards his parents. So they wanted to be koifa him, the Bezna wanted to pressure him, so the Gemara says he can't be koifa, Bezna has no right to be koifa because the mitzvah of Kibud Aviyim, as it appears in the Chumash, has matan schora betzido. It says right next to the mitzvah, kabeda sadich v'esimecha, l'man yarichon yamecha. Whenever the Torah gives you, whenever the Torah promises a reward for performing a certain mitzvah, that itself should serve as the impetus, that itself should serve as the motivation to do the mitzvah. So Bezdin doesn't have to be koifer. So Tosfos asks this famous kasha, why does the Gemara say that you're koifer, we pressure a person, we force a person to give the proper amount of tzedakah if he's not fulfilling the mitzvah? It says in the Chumash that biglal hadover hazeh yivarechach Hashem alakecha, if you give tzedakah you'll be blessed from heaven. So tzedakah should also be considered a mitzvah saseh shematan schar b'tzido, so Bezdin shouldn't have the right to be kaifer. So Tosfos gives several answers, famous answers, and it's famous that some Rishonim give, the Shita Mekubetzes quote, some Rishonim give the following answer, which is questionable. The Gemara is talking about being kofer ala mitzvah. Do we have the right to force you to fulfill a mitzvah? The Gemara says in another place, let's say I owe you $100,000, and the Bezdin says I have to pay. I say, I'm not religious, I don't believe in God, I don't have to keep any mitzvahs. So it has to do with whether you're religious or not. It's not a question of to be kaifa on the mitzvah of priyas bal chayv is a mitzvah. Forget about mitzvah high, forget about the whole religion. You go to shibudim, you owe money, so you have to pay. It's not a topic of, so the same many rishonim are of the opinion that the obligation to give tzedakah is not just a mitzvah, it's considered a shibud. You owe the money to the other person. Vezna is gova. They collect the money that you owe to the others. That's very questionable whether that's true. So a group of rishonim claim that the obligation to give tzedakah is considered a shibud. That's how the Rambam writes in the Mor Nevuchim. The Rambam says that the word tzedakah, when you add a hey at the end of the word, so it means something in a smaller form. Like my name is Herschel, so when I was a little boy, so they called me Herschel. My father called me Herschel when I was 65 years old, because in his eyes I was still a little boy. So usually you add on a Yankala. His name is Yankel, and when he's a little child, you call him Yankala. So the Rambam says that tzedakah is basically tzedek. Justice is real justice. When you go to court and someone owes you money, so they have to pay the money. That's justice. And tzedakah is a little bit, a little form of tzedek. He's implying that it's like justice, that you really owe the money to the other person. That's a big question whether that's the case or not. So this mitzvah of tzedakah depends on how wealthy each person is. Whoever earns more money, so the Gemara says, if he's giving a little bit of tzedakah, but he's not giving what he should give, considering how much he's earning, so the bezin will be koy for him to give more. So how much is a person supposed to give? So the Gemara never has this comment. The Tosfos and Tainus in the first pera quotes a comment from the Sifrei on the Pasuk in Parshas Re'eh, Aserti aseris kol tvua zarecha hayotze hasod shono shono. And the Gemara has a big machlokes that appears in many different mesichtes. The Chumash has very often lashonos kfulim. You have a verb that's repeated twice. Hanitanik, nosim titen, basach tiftach. Do we assume Dibur Torah k'lashon b'nei Adam? HaKadosh Baruch Hu dictated the Chumash to Moshe Rabbeinu in a way that people speak, and people speak with adding on extra words, extra phrases, and it doesn't necessarily imply anything. That's the opinion of Rabbi Shmuel, and we follow Rabbi Akiva's opinion that lo Dibur Torah k'lashon b'nei Adam. HaKadosh Baruch Hu dictated the Chumash to Moshe Rabbeinu word for word, letter for letter, in such a way that every word has meaning and every letter has significance. So when you have the Shonas Kfulim, when you have a verb that's repeated, there must be some reason why it's repeated. So the Sifrei has the comment. This Stam Sifrei follows the Beis Medrash of Rabbi Akiva. So Rabbi Akiva's Talmidim, Darshan, that the Pasuk says, Aser te Aser, it's marba something in addition to maestras. Whatever grows in Eretz Yisrael, fruits or vegetables or grain, whatever grows, you have to be marfish, chumas, and maestras. You're not permitted to eat it if you're not marfish. It's a prohibited, it's an iser tevel. But the extra word, the extra verb, aser ti aser, it's written twice, implies that a person who doesn't grow food on a farm in Eretz Yisrael also has to give maisek sofim. You have to give away to aniyim one-tenth of how much you earn. So this is a comment that the Sifrei has. It never appears in the Gemara. Only appears in the Sifrei. It appears in Chumash. It says in Parshas Lech Lecha that there was the war between the five kings and the four kings. And then after Avraham Avinu won the whole war and he acquired ownership of all of the nine cities, there's an international principle of Kibush Muhammad that's derived from Sukkim and Tanakh, that if one country wins a war against another country, whether you had a right to wage the war, you didn't have a right to wage the war, whoever wins the war acquires ownership of all of the people and the property and the land, everything belongs to the winner. So the Pasuk says Avraham Avinu just beat out the four kings, he'll beat out the five kings. They just acquired ownership of all the nine cities. So the first thing he does is, Vayitan lo maisa miko. He bumped into Malkit Tzedek, Melech Sholem. And Rashi quotes the Medrash, that was Shem, the son of Noach. He had a yeshiva, Shiva Shem the Aver, later his son Aver. So the first thing Avraham Avinu does is that he gives maisa ksofim. And then the rest of the property that he just acquired ownership, he gave it back. He says, I don't want to have anything over here. But the Maisek Sofim, he felt he had to give. And in today's Sedra, we read that when Yaakov Avinu is running away from his brother Esav, so he promises HaKadosh Baruch Hu. HaKadosh Baruch Hu tells him, I'm going to protect you when you go into Golus, don't worry. So Yaakov Avinu promises, he takes a pledge that whatever I learn, I'll give Maisik Sofim. So we see that Avraham Avinu gave Maisik Sofim and Yankev gave Maisik Sofim. So it certainly is a nice thing to do. The question is, how serious do we take this drasha? That the Tanoim Darshan from the Pasuk, Aser Ta'aser, that you have to give Maisik Sofim. So you look in the Shulchan Aruch, they present three different positions. So the Ravid's opinion is that this is a real drasha, it's a real din daraisa. It's a biblical din. And it has the status of Maisa Oni. So if you give your Maisik Sofim to yeshivas, or to hospitals, or to the shul, or to the local mikveh, you're not yotzei the mitzvah. Just like Maisa Oni, in Eretz Yisrael, the third year and the sixth year of the Shemitah cycle, you have to set aside through Megdoyla Maisa Rishon and Maisa Oni. Maisa Oni goes to Aniv. You can't sell it and give the money to a yeshiva. So the Ravid is of the opinion that Maisa Ksofim is a din daraisa. It has the status of Maisa Oni and has to be Mischalik Laniyim, only to the poor. The Ravid's opinion has clearly not been accepted. The Taz in Yerideh has a long essay. It's in Shin Lamed Aleph. In the Shulchan Aruch, they have very little about the mitzvahs HaTluyos Baris. Even Rabbi Yosef Kara lived in Eretz Yisrael. He lived in Tzfat in the 1500s, but there were hardly no Jewish farmers at that time. They were busy writing Lucha Doidi and Shulchan Aruch and Beis Yosef. There were no Jewish farmers. The word went around that if the Jews would plant anything, nothing would grow. So the Arabs were growing everything. So they had no issues. So there's hardly anything in Shulchan Aruch about the mitzvahs of Tluyos Baris. So everything is put into one siman, in Shin Lamed Aleph and Yeridei. So the Taz has a long essay there, and he says, well, something is applicable today, the Maisek Sofim, and he says that we assume that it's not Minatur, we assume it's Midirabonim. And the drasha that the Sifrei made on the Pasuk is assumed to be an Asmachta. It's only a remez, it's not a bona fide drasha. The later Paskim say, We don't even accept what the Taz says. We don't really think that it's a din derabanan either. We assume that it's a recommended midas chasidus. It's a minik toiv. And many of the poskim say that the first time a person gives maisek sofim, first time in his lifetime he gives maisek sofim, he should either have in mind or say explicitly b'li neder, just in case he'll have a year where it's going to be too difficult to fulfill this minik toiv, so he won't be obligated to do it. We assume that it's a recommended midas chasidus to give the maisek sofim, but again, there are no discussions in the Gemara. The whole concept is not never mentioned in the Gemara. It's only in the Sifrei. In fact, there's an interesting tshuva in the Nodi Behuda where they asked him, what is the cutoff point for maisek sofim? When is the Rosh Hashanah for maisek sofim? Let's say you earned money, you lost money, so do you calculate from Tu Bishvat to Tu Bishvat, or do you calculate from Rosh Hashanah to Rosh Hashanah? What is the cutoff point? So the Nadi Behuda said he really doesn't like to write tshuvas about these topics because there's no discussion in the Talmud on it. So whatever you're going to say is going to be aboich svar. That's what he writes. Svaras hakeres. It's going to be aboich svar. He doesn't want to take a stand on it, but you keep on nudging me, keep on sending me letter after letter, so you had to take a stand. So I think he says Tu Bishvat. He makes up his mind. Tu Bishvat to Tu Bishvat, you have to calculate. So that Maisek Sofim is a recommended Midas Chasidus. And we assume that the Maisek Sofim does not necessarily have to be given a dafka to Aniyim. If you give it to any charitable cause, give it to the shul, give it to the yeshivas, you give it to the hospital and so on, one would also be in fulfillment of Maisek Sofim. The Gemara comments on the Pasuk in today said, Rekola shatitin li aser asrenu loch. Why does Yaakov Avinu repeat the verb twice, aser asrenu? So the Gemara Ksuba says on Daf Nun, Usha Hiskino, when the Bez Nagadol was in the city Usha after the destruction of the second Beis Hamikdash, and it made a takana that Hamavazvez al Yavazvez Yosem Echadish. One who's giving charity, we recommend he should give 1/10, okay, but we insist that he shouldn't give more than 1/5. If he's going to give more than 20%, Shema Yeoni, be it Starch Labrias, he may go broke, and then he'll have to go Shnora, Stalker for himself. So that doesn't make any sense. He should give away too much stock and then he may become poor, so that's not permissible. So the Gemara says that's the maximum. Unless a person is making a fortune of money, so he's not going to go broke, he's not going to become poor. But for the average person, it makes a parnasa, so we would recommend Hamavazvez Ayavazvez Yaisam Echemish. The Gemara there comments, however, that this is only called when the person is alive. When a person is about to die, and he wants to give money to tzedakah, so there's no concern. Shema yayani v'tzarech labrias. Not afraid he'll go broke, and he's holding by dying already. He makes out a will. So he's not talking about while he's alive. If he's giving after he dies, so then the Gemara says you're permitted to give more than chaimish, more than 20%. The Gemara just says that there's another issue. It's not permissible to be ma'aber nachla. Not only if you have children, let's say one doesn't have children, he has cousins, whatever, relatives, so you're not allowed to cheat the relatives of their Yerusha. The Gemara tells a story that there was a Tana Yosef ben Yoezer, who lived at the time of the second Beis HaMikdash. He was a Tana, and his son was not a Tana. His son was a Balabas, and he was so upset why his son didn't want to go into learning also to become a Tana like the father. So he said he's going to give away all of his money to the Beis HaMikdash. The other Tanaim said, you're not allowed to. And he didn't listen to them. He gave away all of his money. How much money did he have already? He said, Tana, how much money? What did he do for a living? So the Gemara says he gave whatever. He gave away his whole, the Gans of Hameg, and he gave it to the Beis HaMikdash. And then the Gemara says that the son was a nice businessman, and he gave way more than the father. The Gemara says the Gemara condemns the father. Yosef ben Yezid did wrong. He didn't listen to the other Rabbanim. You're not permitted to be Ma'aber Nachla. So that's a famous discussion that they have in Chosha Mishpat. How much do you have to leave to the children that it shouldn't be a violation of Ma'aber Nachla? The Gemara says you're not allowed to be Ma'aber Nachla even Mibro Bisha Lebro Tava. Even if one son is Ratna, and one son is good, you're not allowed to take away the Yerusha from the bad son. Unless what does it mean, Brabisha? He didn't get along with the father. He said, Brabisha doesn't keep Shabbos and Kasha. He married a non-Jewish woman. So that's you are permitted to be Ma'aber Nachla there. But if he's not such a wonderful son, so the Gemara says, it's not right to be Ma'aber Nachla. Maybe he'll have, maybe his grandchildren. Maybe the grandchildren will be fine. So how much do you have to leave to the Yorushim that one should not be in violation of this prohibition of being Ma'aber Nachla? So that's a big dispute. So there's a popular set of Svarim, the Gesher HaChayim, and Hilchas Avelis, many people use it, by Rabbi Chil Michal Tikachinsky. So his position was, he quotes earlier Paschal, his position was, you have to leave 51%, you have to leave Roiv to the Yorshim, and then the 49% you can do whatever you want. So the son, Rabbi Michal Tikachinsky's son, Rabbi Nissen Tikachinsky, who I think passed away already, so he wrote in the introduction to the later editions of the Gesher HaChayim, when his father was about to die, so he gave instructions they should do everything the way he wrote in the Sefer. They should light a candle and open the window and do this and do that. And he gave away 49% of how much more assets did he have? $150 or something. He gave 49% of his assets to tzedakah, and 51% of the assets he left Birusha for the son. So that is one opinion, but that's not the generally accepted opinion. Rav Moshe Feinstein writes that the general accepted opinion is like the Chasam Sofer quoted by the Pischei Tshuva. The Chasam Sofer says as long as the father or as long as the Morish, whoever, the rich uncle who's passing away, as long as the one who is about to die is going to leave a significant amount to each one of the Yorshim, so that satisfies the issue of not being Ma'aber Nachla, and then you can give even more than 49% away to tzedakah. So what's considered a significant amount? That changes in different generations. When Moshe Feinstein wrote this tshuva 40 years ago, so he says, if the father leaves $10,000 to each one of the children, that's more than enough. Maybe at that time. It depends how much money he has. You have to take everything into consideration. But that's what we assume. If the Morish will leave a significant amount of money for each one of the Yorshim who are in line to get the Yerusha, we assume he's permitted to leave over even more than 49% to tzedakah. And this was always a Jewish practice. In fact, I have discussions of this. We were just discussing before we started the Nash that the Acharonim recommend that one should fill out a will when he reaches the age of 50. I'm a little over 50, much over 50. So when I reach the age of 50, I made out a will. And my wife also, she's younger than me, so we made out a will at that time. They quote the Pasuk, the Pasuk isn't talking about a will. The Pasuk is talking in the 50th year when the Jubilee year comes, so everyone has a right to get back their farm or their house in Eretz Yisrael that was sold to someone else. That's one of the dinim. When it comes Yom Kippur Shel Yovel, so whoever had his day achuza gets it back. Whoever bought it as a stay mikna has to return it to the rightful owner. So that's this simple shot. Toshuvu isha lachuzasai. Everybody gets back the ownership of the Steachus. And the Achrayim took it as a remez, when a person reaches the age of 50, he should start thinking about Toshuvu Isha Lachuzasa. You should start thinking about returning back to your maker. and therefore you should fill out a will. So a person, the proper thing is a person should fill out a will, and he should leave over a significant amount to the for the Yorshim who are in line to get the Yerusha, and then the rest they should leave to Tzedakah. In fact, the Achronim quotes Pasuk in Tanakh, V'halach lefanecha tzidkecha, that if possible, the proper thing to do is to give the money to the tzedakah before the person is buried. I remember when my father-in-law passed away, Takawi Meira, he died on the Shabbos, and he was buried in Eretz Yisrael, and we sent out the checks in the mail before the burial took place. We made out the checks, and my father passed away a couple of years ago, so my father, I think, was given bad advice. He wrote in his will, percent, instead of saying amounts, how much to give to each tzedakah, he wrote percentages of his assets. So percentages, it took forever, it took over a year, till they assessed how much is how much the whole Yerusha wasn't worth so much, but it took forever till they assessed it. So I didn't think it was so smart on the part. He had a lawyer who was a Muslim from Yeshiva who was guiding him. I didn't think it was such a good etzer to give percentages. So we were not able to make out any checks before he was buried. It took a very long time. There is a Seder Kedimas in giving tzedakah, and the Seder Kedimas doesn't mean which tzedakah do you give first, like you put on the Shalyad first and then the Shalroish. That's a Kedimah. Here it does mean a Kedimah, whom do you give the money to first. It doesn't matter which one you're giving first, who's getting second. The Seder Kedimah means you don't have unlimited funds. So if you have so much money to give to tzedakah, how much do you give to this organization? How much do you give to that organization? So the Gemara has a little bit, and the Shulchan Aruch has much more based on the Rambam, based on Sifrei. So the rules are, first come the Aniyim and the family. They get the Seder Kedima. And then they give you rules and regulations. So it's called, exactly how far does that go? The third cousin is also called family. So they give you the guidelines, who is considered family. They say that if one is divorced from his wife, it's also considered family. If the former wife needs money, it's also considered family. One should be kind to his former wife, and Mibsoch al Tesalim applies to one's former wife also. So the first kedima is, many of the Paskim say the kedima means two-thirds and one-third. It means like this, if I have, you don't have unlimited funds, let's say I have $50,000 this year to give to tzedakah. So how much of the $50,000 should go to my relatives? I happen, Baruch Hashem, none of my close relatives are in need. Let's say some of them would be in need, so I give the whole $50,000 to them. So we assume no. Up until two-thirds of the $50,000 should be given to close relatives that they need it, and the one-third should be divided among everybody else. Once the close relatives are taken care of, let's say they don't even need the two-thirds, so whatever is left, you again divide two-thirds and one-third. So two-thirds go to the Aniye Ircha, the people, the poor people in your city. We'll have to give a definition. New York is a very big city, so we'll give a definition soon. And then one-third goes to the rest of the world. If the Aniye Ircha are taken care of in but less than two-thirds, fine. So then you have more money to divide Vaita. So then the next Kedima is Aniye Yerushalayim. And there are many of them, so they'll get their full two-thirds. Okay. And then if there's any money left, there should be one-third left after that. So that one-third should go to the rest of the Aniyim in Eretz Yisrael. And then the rest of the Aniyim, two-thirds of the money that's left after Aniyah Yerushalayim goes to the Aniyah Eretz Yisrael. And the one-third, the last one-third, the final last one-third goes to the Aniyim in the rest of the world. There's a yeshiva in Manchester who send me letters they want, and the yeshivas in Australia used to be taken care of by Mr. Gutnick. And now they're coming to Schnarrigelt in America. So the rest of the world is the bottom of the list. So the Seder Kedimas goes again, two-thirds and one-third. That's how the Chochma Sodom writes, that's how Ramosha writes in his Tshuvas. If necessary, two-thirds of the full amount that you have to give to the tzedakah should go to your mishpacha if they need it. And what's left should be divided again, two-thirds and one-third, two-thirds to Aniyah Ircha. When it's left after that, two-thirds should go to Aniyah Yerushalayim. And then two-thirds should go to Aniyah Yeretz Yisrael, and the last one-third should go to the Aniyim and the rest of the world. Exactly what does it mean, Aniyah Ircha? It means all the Aniyim in New York City. I don't know who in the world they are. I never met them. So the Pashat Pshat is, I was told that Rav David Feinstein said this also, but I think this is the Pashat Pshat. Pashat Pshat is, Aniyah Ircha means if you have a little village and I associate with these people. So the poor people that I have a shaychus to, that's called Aniyah Ircha. So all the I live in Washington Heights. So the aniyim in Washington Heights, those on the Yerchon. The yeshivas where I went, where my children went, where my grandchildren go to school. So that's on the Yerchon. When my father made out his will, so he had many grandchildren who are married already. So he gave out percentages to all the different yeshivas. So I have one son in law who learned in Merkaz Harav, so my father left an amount to Merkaz Harav. I have one of my sons in law learned in Skokie Yeshiva. The bulk of what he was giving, he gave to Yeshiva University. Because most of our family, we all learned in YU. So that's the charity begins at home. And then he gave also to Merkaz Harav and to Shalavim. One son in law learned to Shalavim. One of my sons learned in Kerem Yavne, so he gave a certain amount to Kerem Yavne. That's all Aniyei Yerchon, the institution, the mikveh that my wife uses, that's Aniyei Yerchon. The other mikvahs that we never use, that's not Aniyei Yerchon. You give a donation once in a while, but that's Aniyei Yeracheres. You're not Mechuyev. We were just talking before, one of the Mishalachim came from Eretz Yisrael, and he was collecting money for Yerusha, for some institution in Yerushalayim. So he tells me that Rav Yashiv Paskin, that Aniya Yerushalayim take precedence to Aniya Yerchon. So I told him it's a lie. Rav Yashiv doesn't paskin against the Shulchan Aruch. It says explicitly in the Shulchan Aruch, Aniya Yerchon take precedence to Aniya Yerushalayim. That's the lineup. There's no machlekes on that. The Chasam Sofer has a tshuva about this, and he spells it out that that's what it says in Shulchan Aruch. The Kedima saw the Aniyim from the Mishpacha, and then the Aniyim Aniya Yerchon first, and then come Aniya Yerushalayim, Aniya Eretz Yisrael, and the Shar Aniyim and the rest of the world, all the other tzarochim. In the yeshiva last year, there was an issue. There was a religious balabos who lived in Argentina, if I'm not mistaken, who pledged to give $100,000 to the local yeshiva. And he passed away before he had a chance to give the money. And he had two children, a son and a daughter. So the son is not yet religious, as Rabbi Yudin would say. Son is not yet religious. So he was not interested in honoring the father's pledge to give the $100,000 to the yeshiva. And the daughter lives in New York. And her husband is a big doctor in Columbia Presbyterian. And he learns in yeshiva every day. He goes to a shiur, he goes to Rabbi Sachs's shiur every day. And he learns in the base manager, she and the son. They learn in the base manager every day. So the son was not aware of the halacha that when there's a son and a daughter, so the son, strictly speaking, the son gets the whole yerusha, the daughter doesn't get anything. So he assessed the value of the whole estate of the father. He made out a check to his sister for half of the amount. He decided he's going to divide 50-50. Very nice. So the son-in-law was asking the base medrash, what's the din? The father-in-law pledged to give $100,000, so the son doesn't want to give anything, so the daughter got half of the estate. Is she obligated to give the full $100,000? Is she obligated to give $50,000? Or maybe she's obligated to give nothing because the father died. The father died, so he can't fulfill his mitzvah to observe his pledge. And maybe there's no din that the nechasim are meshubed. So this was a big dispute in many generations. And the famous dispute was in the 1500s. Rabbi Yosef Kara lived in Tzfas. And the Ramah lived in Krakow, in Poland, and they corresponded on this issue. They have machlokes on this issue. So Rabbi Yosef Kara was of the opinion that when you pledge money to tzedakah, mirosa lagavaya, it doesn't only create an obligation, mitam mitzvahs neder, motzvah sechatishma, v'yasisa, kashen adarta, l'asham al-kech anadova, kashen dibarta b'ficha, you have to keep your word for a neder mitzvah. Rabbi Yosef Karev is of the opinion that it creates Shiva Nechasim. Amirasa Lagavaya, Kimsirasa Lahedya, applies to Tzedakah. So if the man pledged to give $100,000 and he dies, all the Nechasim are Meshubed, and you can collect the money from the estate after he dies. And the Ramah disagreed. The Ramah was a machlekes in the days of the Rishon, the days of the Baal Yatah. The Ramah was of the opinion that you're only Mechuyiv Mitam Neder, and there's no Shiva Nechasim on the Nechasim. Here the issue was, so that was one question. Do we paskin like the Ramah? Do we paskin like the Beis Yosef? Because it would appear that many of the Ashkenazi paskin paskin like the Beis Yosef over here. The Chasam Sofer seems to follow the Beis Yosef, that there is Shiba Nechasim. But then, maybe the Nechasim, maybe the estate was Meshubah to pay the $100,000, but the daughter didn't get any of the estate. The brother made out a check to her, so she didn't get actually any of the estate that had the Shiba Nechasim. the brother wasn't really mechuyev, strictly speaking, to give her a penny, because he got the whole, the father never made it tzavur. So strictly speaking, the whole Yerusha goes to the son. So that was the big pilpul in the yeshiva last year. The topic of tzedakah is a very significant one. Torah promises, ki biglal adar hazeh yivarechecha Hashem elokecha. Everybody wants to get a bracha. Let me just close with the comment of the Abarbanel on the pasuk. The pasuk says, we are encouraged to give tzedakah ki, because lo yechdal evyon mikerev haaretz. There will always be poor people. We will never be able to solve the issue of poverty. So the sociologist asked, if anything, that's a reason why not to give tzedakah. What are you wasting the time to give tzedakah? You're never going to, there are always going to be poor people. Let's say there's a dam holding back all the water, and then there's a hole in the dam. So the man puts his hand by the hole. How long is he going to stand there? Then there's another hole, puts his hand over there. Then there's a third hole. So what's he going to do? Whatever you're going to do, the flood is going to come anyway. You can't prevent the flood from coming. So the Torah says, you will never be able to solve the problem of ki lo yechta lev yimkev. So what are you wasting time giving charity to the poor if you're not going to solve the problem? So it's a problematic pasuk. And then the pasuk ends off, ki biglal adavar hazeh yivarechecha Hashem elokecha. As a reward for fulfilling the mitzvah of tzedakah, HaKadosh Baruch Hu will bless you. So the Talmud in the end of Masechet Shabbos has a comment on that word, biglal adavar hazeh, that poverty is a galgal hachoizah ba'olam, that you never have one family that for 30, 40 generations in a row, they're always wealthy. Every family at some time or another will be hit with poverty. Maybe for 10 generations they'll be wealthy, the 11th generation will be poor. Why did the rabbis decide to comment on that pasuk? Biglal adavar hazeh. So the Abarbanel has the following comment. Rav Soloveitchik liked this comment, so he said it over in his shiurim. So the Abarbanel says the obligation to give charity is because it's reciprocal. Today you have the money, he doesn't have it, but in the future you may be poor, or your descendants may be poor, and there'll be a need for charity. So you're obligated to do for others because they're obligated to return the taiva to you. The Gemara says, the one who goes to be mevakeh cholim, people will go be mevakeh cholim when he's sick. The one who dances at other people's weddings, so when he marries off his children, they'll dance at his wedding. The one who delivers a hesped when someone else dies, so people will be nice to him, they'll deliver a nice hesped when he dies. Whatever you do, b'nodah machaveira will be returned to you later on. All of the shibudim, all of the mitzvahs, b'nodah machaveira, are all reciprocal. So that's what the pasuk says. You should give tzedakah because ki lo yechta lev yamikerev haaretz. There will always be poor people, and someday you may be the lucky winner. You may be the poor person because poverty is a galgal achayz ba'olam. Biglal adav razeh, poverty is a galgal achayz ba'olam. Even if you think that you'll never be poor, maybe one of your descendants in the future will be poor. So the Torah encourages us all, we should give tzedakah to those who need, in exchange for which we will be taken care of in the future when we will be in need. Thank you very much.
Rav Schechter will answer questions after the presentation by Jonathan Schmel.
Thank
Jonathan.
You. Thank you. My presentation is not going to be that in-depth or that long. When Yoni Shankman broached this idea, he said, since we're talking about charity, since that's the topic, I'd like you to talk about when a client comes to you or a prospective client comes to you and is looking for planning on charitable giving, what are some of the things that you tell them? So I'm just going to go over just briefly some of the basic rules in the U.S. tax law on the giving of charity. I know we have a very diverse crowd here, so we're going to try to keep it somewhat basic. Again, Miriam Greenberg, who works with me, is here with me. She's going to answer all the really hard questions. And so that's really what we want to talk about. And we're at the end of the year now. We're coming to the end of the Seth Bueller year, and a lot of people are obviously doing the year-end planning. And part of, again, year-end planning involves charitable giving. The U.S. tax law does subsidize, does give you a deduction, does give you a tax benefit for giving charity to appropriate organizations. So, again, that's part of tax planning, and we're accountants, so that's part of what we do here. So I just want to go through some of the basic rules. First of all, when a person gives something to charity, if it's cash, obviously cash is cash, and we know what that's worth. If you give property, you can deduct fair market value is the basis for your deduction. And if you're giving property, generally one gets an appraisal for that, and we'll go over some of those rules. If you're giving property, though, there are three exceptions to that fair market value deduction that I just want to mention. If a person gives what's called ordinary income property, such as inventory, then that would be limited to your taxpayer's basis. That would not qualify for a fair market value deduction. The second rule is if a person gives tangible personal property, which is put to an unrelated use by the charity. So if you give a piece of art to a museum, that would be related use. But if you gave a piece of art to your child's school's goods and services auction, I suppose that would be an unrelated use since it's not going to use that piece of art. So that would be, again, limited to your cost basis. And the third exception would be long-term capital gain property given to a private foundation. So I'm going to get into, in a few minutes, a little bit more about private foundations and what type of people set those up. But again, if you give long-term capital gain property to a private foundation, if it's stock, you would get a fair market value deduction. But if it's something other than that, if you gave land to your family foundation, again, it would be limited to cost. So those are things that come up all the time and questions that we see, again, with our clients and prospective clients. When a person gives a charitable deduction, there are limitations on how much you could deduct. If a person's income is, make them a number, $100,000, they can't just give $100,000 to charity and wipe out their income. It's limited. So if you, a person, a taxpayer, would give cash to what's called a public charity, a charity that's supported by the public, it would be limited to 50% of what's called their adjusted gross income. If they give capital gain property, it's limited to 30% of their income. Again, if you're giving money to your family foundation, if it's cash, it's 30% of your income, and it's property, it's limited to 20% of your income. And if you exceed that percentage, that threshold, you can carry those amounts forward for the next 5 years as long as you have income in the subsequent years. But you can carry that forward. And we have some very philanthropic and generous clients who oftentimes take advantage of that 5-year carryover because they give more than the tax law would allow them in the current year. Again, everybody should be very generous with themselves. If you have out-of-pocket expenses, fully deductible. If mileage for your car, if you're going to a charitable event, is deductible, I think it's now 14 cents a mile. We should all give our time for charity, but giving your time for charity is not deductible. Our time is all very valuable, but it's not a deductible item. And permitting somebody to use your property, using this room, Grant Thornton is not going to get a tax deduction for letting YU alumni use this room. That's not a deductible. Sorry, Jack. That's not deductible.
Well, we deducted it as a business expense.
Oh, okay. Don't tell him about it. Anyway, it's also important to understand where you're giving your money, the nature of the organization. We see sometimes people giving lists of taxpayers giving us lists of organizations, and you look at the list, and those are not deductible organizations. They're professional organizations, business leagues. And I would tell everybody to check what's called IRS Publication 78, which is online. And it has a list of every organization and what type of charity it is. So it's also very important to be mindful of where you're actually, or your client or taxpayers are giving money. Make sure they're really valid charitable organizations recognized by the Internal Revenue Service. Timing is very important also. When is the deduction, when is the contribution deductible? And people ask this all the time. People call up and say, well, I'm putting a charge on my credit card for a charity, and people do that quite frequently now. They have a pledge and they charge it to their credit card instead of writing out a check. So when is that deductible? So that's deductible when your Visa or MasterCard is actually debited by the organization, and if you pay your Visa bill a month later, it's not deductible when you actually pay the credit card company, but it's deductible when your credit card is actually charged. We also see people giving property to organizations. Donations of property, the donation has to be a completed gift. The title has to transfer. You can't continue, you can't say I'm going to give this piece of art to a museum and yet it's still hanging in my living room over my couch. It's not a completed gift. It has to actually, it has to be a full transfer and you have to relinquish title and ownership. A promissory note has to be paid off. A pledge has to be redeemed. Pledges to give are not deductible until you actually write the check. Otherwise, I imagine we'd all be making pledges and maybe not redeeming them. But that's part of the timing rule. Another thing we tell our clients is you need to have receipts. If it's less than $250, canceled check, acknowledgement from the organization, that's valid. If it's in excess of that, you need a receipt. There's certain rules on what a receipt has to say. And if it's property in excess of $5,000, you need a valid appraisal. The appraisal has to come from a qualified appraiser. However, I would just say that if it's stock, publicly traded securities that you can check in a Bloomberg terminal or something like that, you don't need an appraisal for that. That's pretty obvious that you can get that value. It's public the knowledge. I just like to mention some of the strategies that people, the taxpayers, use. This is some of the things we talk about with our clients. Again, to maximize the benefit of a charitable gift. Giving appreciated property to charity. If you have stock that's appreciated substantially, land or something like that, again, if a taxpayer would sell that, take in the income on the gain, and then pay tax on that gain, there's less cash left over to now give to charity. So oftentimes we tell taxpayers, if you have appreciated property, donate the appreciated property. You don't have to recognize the gain, but you get the deduction for the full fair market value. The converse is true. Your property has depreciated or declined in value, better to sell it, take the loss, and then give the cash to the charity. So those are kind of obvious, very common planning strategies, again, that most taxpayers employ. For the next 4 weeks, and it's going to expire unless Congress changes their mind, a taxpayer, if you're over 70 and a half, can take cash from his or her IRA and make a direct transfer to a public charity. And that way you don't have to recognize income when you take your required minimum distribution from your IRA, take income and then give the donation. You can make it direct. It has to be direct. So it has to go directly from your IRA, from the custodian, directly to the charity. You can't take the money and then write the check. But by doing that, again, you don't get a deduction for the charity, but you don't have income either. And this can be very beneficial, again, for some states. A lot of states don't give you a charitable deduction. New York State for higher income people, charitable deductions have been phased down to 25%. So this is another common strategy that's going to expire in a few weeks, at the end of the year. We have a lot of clients who set up private family foundations, and we have a lot of clients with these. And if you're going to set up a private foundation, it's best if we're talking about a significant sum of money. It requires hiring an attorney to set up the organization. It requires an administrative burden. You have to file a tax return every year, which is good for us. It gives us work. There's an excise tax of 2% of the net investment income, which you have to pay to the government. So there's certain burdens of having this, but a lot of people like to set these up for a variety of reasons. First of all, they can get a deduction today. If they have a lot of money, they have a lot of income today, they want to get a big deduction. They can put the money into the foundation and they get a deduction today. And they don't have to give out that money immediately. You only have to give out approximately 5% of the assets every year to charity. So you can accumulate money in your foundation and over time slowly send it out to the public charities. Sometimes you have people that believe this will bring their family together. We'll set up an endowment, we'll set up a foundation, we'll get together for family meetings, we'll talk about where we want to give it, and it'll create some sense of family unity after perhaps an older person is gone, he or she feels that their later generations who may not be philanthropic will not be forced to give money to charity because his money's been set aside in this foundation. So people sometimes want to do it anyway. And I think also there's a little bit of perhaps we shouldn't diminish the snob appeal of saying I have a family foundation. In some circles, that's very important. So people set these up. But again, like I said, there's a lot of administrative burdens that go along with this. So we see a lot of clients setting up donor-advised funds. And a donor-advised fund accomplishes basically the same thing. You call up a company, you call up the Jewish Communal Fund has one, or you can call up Charles Schwab, T. Rowe Price, Fidelity, and you can set up a family foundation. You put money in, you set up an account. It's a public charity, not a private foundation. And again, you can get a deduction today for transferring money in. And then over time, you can slowly give it out again to public charities. So a lot of people, again, find that a very good strategy and works for a lot of people. And finally, the last strategy that I want to mention are charitable trusts. We have a lot of clients that have charitable trusts. There are two types of charitable trusts that are most common, which one is called the Charitable Remainder Trust, known as CRATS or CRUTS. And the idea of a charitable remainder trust is I have an asset. Perhaps it's appreciated substantially in value. Perhaps it doesn't even generate income, like a piece of land. And I put it in the charitable remainder trust. The charitable remainder trust can sell that. There's no tax on the capital gain. And then you take those proceeds. You can buy a diversified portfolio that creates income, like perhaps a bond portfolio or a stock portfolio. And you or your family members, your beneficiaries, will get an annuity. And then at some point in the future, whatever's left will go to the charity. You will get a charitable deduction today for the fair market value, well, the present value of the value of that property. And today, in a low interest rate environment, that could be very beneficial. The present value is higher. So we see a lot of people setting up that type of trust. The flip side would be something called a charitable lead trust, which is just the opposite, known as a CLAT or a CLUT, where the charity gets the annuity, and again, the donor himself, herself, would get the property at the end of the term. And again, you can create a tax deduction for this, for the present value of that flow. So we see people setting up those. I know we have somebody. Are you him? Yeah. Very good. I see that. Good. Henry Rubin from the YU Charitable Giving Office came. I'm sure he sets these up a lot for a lot of people that want to give money to YU and other types of organizations. So if you have specific questions about that, this is something that he specializes in. So people want to ask him about that, or you want to talk about that for 2 or 3 minutes. But again, so those are the types of strategies that we see taxpayers and clients employing, again, to manage their charitable giving and to try to maximize the benefit from the charitable giving. And that's really all I have to say. If people have specific questions or you want to talk about it after, we certainly can talk about it.
All right, thank you very much to the panel. We'll open it up to a few minutes of questions, then let people get more food, and there's some beer over here, and open it up to networking also. We have Miriam Greenberg, from a managing partner here at the firm in the tax department, and we have Henry Rubin, head of planning giving at YU. So if anyone has any questions, and of course Rob Schefter and Jonathan Schmelz, if anyone has any questions, we could open up to a Q&A here.
Couple of questions. One to Jonathan. You made a comment that time is not deductible, but what about pro bono work? That's usually a deductible account. Since I'm a CPA and I'm donating my time to as a CPA to a charity, that is deductible, isn't it? As long as I give an invoice.
Well, I suppose if you gave an invoice and then they paid you and you gave back the money,
no,
you'd have been...
basically it's in-kind giving.
Hmm.
It's going to be short in there. It's short on their income statement as an increase in an income increase in expenses, but on my side comes out as a deduction because I donated my time. And
right.
Marked it how much it was worth.
I don't think it would be deductible because I don't think you have a basis in that because you haven't recognized an income yet. That's what I would think. And we have a lot of tax attorneys here. If somebody has a different view, I'm more than happy to.
Isn't he donating a service, not a unit of time?
I think, Jonathan, that you're right, because people often give their time,
right.
And they do it to be good, but they also sometimes wonder if maybe I can get some tax benefit out of it, and unfortunately I have to tell people who give highly trained attorneys and accountants, etc., I have to tell them that unfortunately they can't deduct the billable hours they would have billed.
I mean, to the best of my knowledge, it's not. If you look at the amount of people who contribute hundreds of hours to charities and serving on boards and strategy for yeshivas around the whole metropolitan area, for example, the general world will be taking deductions like it's gone out of style, including me in many cases. So I would say that to the best of my knowledge, it's not.
When you pay taxes to the government, a lot of it is wasted, but some of it goes to charitable institutions, food stamps and health care and all kinds of things that one could consider charitable help for the poor. You get credit for tzedakah by giving taxes.
That percentage of your tax, a certain percentage of all the tax goes for a charitable, that percentage is counted as ma'aseh k'sofim. In fact, there was an opinion that all of the taxes that you pay are counted as ma'aseh k'sofim based on a passage in the Talmud that it's all considered tzedakah. But that far we don't go. But the percentage of the money that the American government has that they give towards the poor is
who has the numbers on that.
Sure. We'll call the manager, the budget office.
The government's number.
Related to that question, let's say you want to give Meister and you say it's 10%. What can you deduct off your income to get to an adjusted number that you apply the 10%?
Withholding tax for sure is deducted. That's considered as if you never earned it. And then there's a dispute in the Achrayim. So the earlier Achrayim complain that there's a Midas Chassidus, there's a Yidah Maisek Sofim, and so many Jews are not living up to this requirement. They're not giving the Maisek Sofim. The later Achrayim say, what are you talking about? Everybody's giving way more than Maisek Sofim. So the later Achrayim explain that what they're arguing about is, how do you calculate the Maisek Sofim? So the earlier Achrayim hold that you calculate based on the full amount that you earn minus the withholding tax. And they complained that many, many, many Jews are not giving Maisek. The later Achrayim thought, you're only obligated to give Maisek Sofim what's left after you've spent for your basic necessities. You have to pay rent. I have to pay rent. I have to buy food, clothing. Not talking about birthday parties. Not talking about luxuries. Not talking about vacations in Eretz Yisrael or anything. Just the basic necessities. All of that has to be deducted first. And you only have to pay Maisek Sofim and what's left after you've spent all the money on your basic necessities. The generally accepted opinion is the first way, though, that you have to give Maisek Sofim if you can afford it. If a person can't afford it, he doesn't give. But whoever can afford it, it's assumed the proper practice should be to give Maisek Sofim on the total amount that a person earned minus the withholding tax.
In a sole proprietor in which someone's income is derived directly from the business, and the business does give ma'aser, is the proprietor responsible to give again?
He's the sole proprietor. I don't think so. It's his business.
So he's double taxation.
Yeah. Yeah. And what about if in an LLC, in which the person's income is derived directly from the business as well?
It flows
What's
through,
an LLC?
It flows through, then what will happen is
the partnership.
It'll flow through in its character to the individual, so the individual get the deduction as it passes through from the entity level. So. You know, I don't want to halakha.
And you have a partnership, and the business gave already Maisek Sofim. So everybody's coming.
The mitzvah passes through, too, right?
So if the money's deducted from the business, then the individual's not then responsible to give again?
Right.
Their income is driving the business.
Right, he's a partner in the business, and his business already gave the Maisek Sofim. Sure.
Charitable lead trust that Jonathan mentioned. So if a father puts and actually I could use an example that Henry created called the Jewish lead trust, which you didn't mention. A grandfather sets up a trust for the child and puts, say, $1 million in this lead trust, and for the next 15 years, $60,000 a year goes to Yeshiva University. And at the end of the 15 years, it becomes, in effect, a retirement plan going to the child. And in the interim, meaning 15 years, the grandchild, who the grandfather wants to involve in being active with YU, can decide and discuss with Henry every year where the money should go for purposes of YU. So it's sort of the Jewish lead trust. If you're putting this $1 million into this trust, it's an irrevocable trust. Do you count $1 million as money you've given to charity? But it's really on a present value basis. YU is getting $60,000 a year for the next 15 years. But you're not giving it. The trust is giving it. So it's a different person. What would be attributable to you in looking at how much charity you've given?
Again, it's an irrevocable trust. I don't get a penny back, but not all of it goes to the charity.
But your children will ultimately get probably even more than what you've put in.
Uh-huh.
But each year, the money goes to charity.
Good, Shiloh. Got to figure it out. Okay.
But you're only deducting the present value based on the
amount no
you give.
For gift tax purposes, it's not a charitable
deduction. Yeah.
The tuition in general, yeah. But not just being paid by parents, but being paid by grandparents who first involved in the first place for parents of the children who are going to Shiva, then the tuition if there is could count towards their Meister obligation, and in second instance, grandparents who might not have to be obligated to teach their children to teach the grandchildren.
We were speaking before, Rabbi Breuer, Zechon Levracha, used to tell the parents that as far as taxes is concerned, you can't count any of your tuition payments as a tax deduction. But as far as Maisek Sofim, I think what he said was that 85% of those who pay full 85% of the money that you pay full tuition goes for education of your child, and 50, 15% goes for education of those who can't afford it. So he said that the 15% of the money that you give for those who give full tuition can be counted as part of your Maaser Tzara. As far as grandparents are concerned, so the Rambam distinguishes between the paternal grandfather and the maternal grandfather based on a passage in the Gemara. The Rambam says the paternal grandfather is obligated to pay for the education of the grandchildren. The maternal grandfather should educate the children if he can, but he's not obligated to pay. There's a yeshiva in Lakewood, one of the little chador in Lakewood, where they have special bills that they have sent. They send bills to the grandfathers, the paternal grandfather, that printed on the bottom of the bill, the passage from the Rambam, that the paternal grandfather is obligated to pay. So if you're obligated to pay, so you can't take it off as a tax deduction, unless you're paying full tuition for your grandchildren. So 15% is going as charity to others.
That's it. There's actually, under the tax code, tuition payments are directed from the grandparents to the school is not considered a gift.
Not considered a gift
for gift tax purposes.
Right. If you pay the medical insurance, well, medical if you pay their rent, then that's a gift, and it's a gift that the government charges you a very hefty gift tax on that gift. If you pay for their rent $100,000, there's a government charge you $5,000 for making that gift to your parents. She would approach us, set up plans where grandparents, they said, let's set something up where you enter into a contract to cover your kids' tuition, your grandchildren's tuition for a very long time because you're getting money out of your state, so the cost you get taxed, and your kids don't have to pay the tuition.
But it's still not, it's probably not counted as a charitable donation, though.
No, it's not charity.
Right. But you wouldn't have to pay a gift tax. It wouldn't be a taxable gift.
Right.
That's how it
is.
Is there a distinction from a halachic perspective between the secular part of that of Moody Kodesh and Moody Chol between the Moody Kodesh, which would be able to be teaching Torah, whereas Moody Chol is more of a Tanakh, whatever you want to call it? Of the education.
Neither counts as my successor. The parents are obligated to educate their children to make them be able to make a parnasa. They're obligated to give them a Jewish education. So they're obligated to spend that money. So neither can be deducted as my successor.
When
Shafter,
when you went through the lineup of Amiya etc., within the general community today, is there any lineup between local yeshiva, the shul, the mikvah, is there any priority in terms of giving tzedakah there?
Part of the consideration, the commentaries say, has to be who is in greater need of the money. Let's say the local anim that I need, that I am aware of in Washington Heights, they need a third Shabbos seat. And the anim in Eretz Yisrael don't have bread and water to put, they don't have bread to put on the table. So then, since their need is so much more basic, so the anim who are in need of bread take precedence over the anim who need a third suit for Shabbos. So you have to calculate. We're obligated to give to the Red Cross and to the cancer research and to everything, but there's so many other millions of people that are donating to that, and the yeshivas hardly have anybody donating to them. So we have to support Medinas Yisrael, but all the secular Jews are supporting Medinas Yisrael. The only ones who are supporting the yeshivas are the Orthodox Jews, some of the Orthodox Jews. So we have to give, we have to emphasize more. We have to give more money to those charities that are closer to us, Aniyei Yircha, because they're in greater need than the Red Cross, a greater need than the cancer research. That's part of the calculation.
Yeah.
Can one, with the din of taking care of tzedakah before the Lord, would one be differentiate between creating ownership for the tzedakah and paying the amount? So in other words, if the tzedakah will legally own a right, an asset that it hasn't collected, is that going to be in the kind of stead? Or is it that it's has to be paid? For instance, one makes a pecuniary request for a civil law jurisdiction where there's going to be immediate inheritance. Could that be the crime? And in case even with percentage, the tzedakah didn't know, because the executives didn't know how much was supposed to go to this tzedakah or another, but by the terms of the will, it's at the moment of the katira, the tzedakah actually owned it. We just didn't have didn't know what it is, and then it has to be paid.
But they still recommend that you should give the money before the burial, whenever possible. Yeah. If you give them ownership of a property that they own right away, okay, so they own it.
But the theoretical ownership doesn't work.
Not sufficient for this. It is chassidus.
Requires
actual interest.
So you find a lot of instances in real estate where, as opposed to selling a property, what someone will do is refinance with a sort of a non-recourse loan. Because it's not taxable. So do you have to give Meiser because you're borrowing money, but it's sort of non-recourse and it's another way of exiting or selling an asset?
I'm not familiar with the whole scenario.
But just instead of, if you borrow money, if you are somehow able to borrow a lot of money against something as opposed to selling it, so it's just another way of selling it, do you have to give Meiser on the borrowed funds? But you're
gotta give the money back.
That's why they default on it. If they think they sold it, they really only borrowed against it. So it's not enough.
Didn't make any money. What, he borrowed money?
He borrowed money.
You owned it for many years. You own it, no mortgage or anything, and instead of selling it, you go to a local bank and get a mortgage at 80% of the value, and you do that because then you don't have to pay taxes because you're borrowing money.
So and what's the shaila with it?
And so you're borrowing money, so there should be no meiser, but the money you borrow is not recourse. So if no one can ever come back after you for the money, the worst they can do is take away the property. And so it's a way of getting money out of the building without ever selling it.
But if they take away the property, I lost the property.
But you already cashed out.
Any other questions? It's not incoming. You don't recognize any offers. But that shows you the mindset that you'll never pay.
That's more of an ethical issue.
It's a very interesting
ethical
issue. Everything looks at the fact that he's on the road. You can't go
charter remainder trust, to my knowledge, has a test, a remainder test, that requires that whatever calculations you do have to leave 10% of something, which I'm not quite clear as to what 10% of, really, of what, but there's a 10% number. I'm wondering if you could help me better understand whose lives you can use to make that calculation, and what is that 10%?
Ask Henry Rubin.
What is the 10% of?
I'd be only too thrilled to tell you, because there used to be something I used to call the Chaza Trust. That was an abused charitable remainder trust where you could literally put in, say, $1 million, and you could say, gee, oh, I'd like to get back 30% a year. So basically, you avoid capital gains tax, but by getting back 30% a year, you get back all the money, and the charity ultimately gets nothing. So that's a cost of trust. And people did all sorts of manipulations. Some people did. Nobody that I know. But the federal government grew askance at those kind of abuses. And they declared by rule of law a few years back, it's been about 7 or 8 or 10 years, that, lo and behold, you have to leave something to charity. You need to do a charitable remainder trust. And it was kind of depressing what they required. They said that, gee, when you set up one of these things and you put $1 million in your charitable remainder trust, you've got to leave a blank amount ultimately to charity. And they said, $100,000, 10%. I was disappointed at this. 10% still allows for less donative intent than we would like. But the way they figure it out basically is, if I put $1 million in my charitable remainder trust and I avoid, and it's highly appreciated property, and I avoid paying capital gains tax, and I put in the charitable remainder trust, so the charitable remainder trust, say, can give me back over my life present valued 90% of that $1 million. But present value-wise, 10% ultimately has to be reserved for charity. So that ultimately, at the end of the day, if the charitable remainder trust is based upon my life, or if it's based upon the life of myself and my spouse, or if it's based upon the life, 20 years, then at the end of the term, 10% has got to be reserved for charity.
So 10% of the initial value contributed to the trust?
Yeah, it's a present value kind of a thing where the IRS looks at the so-called AFR rate, the interest rate that they think the money is going to be making, which is incredibly low right now.
Like 1.2 or
something. Yeah, right. It's really wild.
And then the ages that they use to calculate have to be either you or your spouse, the owner or the spouse of the owner.
Unless you do a term of years, that's
right.
One way.
Okay.
And it'll be a 20-year, 10-year, whatever.
Thank you.
Okay, I want to thank everybody for coming, and I wanted to thank the panel again. I encourage everybody to join the AFP network. There's a site on LinkedIn. You could go over to anyone in the Career Services office, and they can help you join. And you'll be informed of upcoming events and networking opportunities, etc. Feel free to stick around. There's some more food and to network with whoever you like. Thanks for coming.
Thank you.
See you. See you. See you. See you. See you. See you. See you. See you. See you. See you. See you. See you. See you. See you. See you. See you. See you. See you. See you. See you. See you. See you. See you. See you. See you. See you. See you. See you. See you. See you. See you. See you. See you. See you. See you. See you. See you. See you. See you. See you. See you. See you. See you. See you. See you. See you. See you. See you. See you. See you. See you. See you. See you. See you. See you. See you. See you. See you. See you. See you. See you. See you. See you. See you. See you. See you. See you. See you. See you. See you. See you. See you. See you. See you. See you. See you. See you. See you. See you. See you. See you. See you. See you. See you. See you. See you. See you. See you. See you. See you. See you. See you. See you. See you. See you. See you. See you. See you. See you. See you. See you. See you. See you. See you. See you. See you. See you. See you. See you. See you. See you. See you. See you. See you. See you. See you. See you. See you. See you. See you. See you. See you. See you.